Dreams in Black Static by Ambrose Ibsen. Performed by Joe Hempel. Neglect a memory long enough, and it'll get soft around the edges. It'll start to dissolve till only the broadest strokes prevail. I believe that it's only because I can no longer recall the man's face with any real firmness that the strange pool of his blank, staring eyes has, in these interstitial years, finally left me, that I can now speak about that night almost half a decade gone. I'm speaking, of course, of that strange man I met on the street on an autumn night. I'm no stranger to the loiterers and buskers that wander the streets of this vast city at all hours, but on that particular evening, as I was leaving work, I found that the rain had largely chased these types away, and I was left to wait alone in front of my office building in the accruing dusk for my taxi. Standing a few paces from the building's side entrance with an umbrella propped against my shoulder, I watched the cold rain fall. Fat drops struck the grimy pavement in a ceaseless cannonade. The cacophony of said drops was rivaled only by the roar of the curbside currents that gushed into the sewers. As I said, I'd thought myself standing alone on that darkening stretch. But some minutes into my wait, I realized this was not the case. To my right, or was it my left? I made out a frail silhouette through the pounding rain. Beneath a tattered awning, there squatted a small, old man clothed in an oversized brown coat. Barely shielded from the rain, the lonesome figure was hunched against the brick facade of the office building and stared out from his huddled pose through narrow lids. I hadn't been aware of his presence more than a minute before I wagered he was staring at me, rather than at some fixture in our waterlogged surroundings. From the battered brown coat, he presented a gnarled little hand. He waved, then drew up a small wooden box, which he shook feebly. The rattle of coinage sounded from within. I thought him perhaps homeless, seeking charity, and having nothing to give was determined to keep my distance. I stared out at the street for a long while then, anxiously awaiting my cab. The wizened man proved relentless in his beckoning, however. At regular intervals, he gave that wooden box of his a shake, and when I chanced to look back at him, he dared another wave. Against my better judgment, I took some few steps back and spared him a little smile. "Sorry," I said. "I don't have any change." That should have been the end of our interaction. But for the noisy crash of the rain, or some willful inattention on his part, he outstretched his neck till his face had emerged past the furthest edge of the awning and leered at me. "I will tell you a story," he croaked, his arthritic paw patting the wooden box. "I have no money," I reiterated. The taxi was still nowhere in sight. I considered then returning to the office and placing another call to the cab company, and in retrospect, I wish I had. The old man didn't hear, or pretended not to hear, and licked at his lips. "For many years now, I have been blind," he began, and he turned his face up towards me, eyes wide as if to offer proof. His eyes had about them a whitish, milky appearance. Even so, one could not help feeling watched through their dead stare. "But when I lost my sight, I gained something more remarkable. In my dreams, yes, my dreams, I am privy to incredible sights. The world of my dreams is a strange one, young man, very strange indeed. And night after night I glimpse things from that other world, bring them back with me. It's a strange sort of world, that one. A world where the darkness prevails and the sun never rises. Imagine seeing the world through a veil of black static, and you'll know what I mean. It is a story of this untrodden country I now bring you."
I should have retreated into the building, should have left the entrance and waited someplace far from the man, but instead I stood and listened to him. What follows, as best I can recall it, was the old man's story, his so-called dream in black static. I wish I'd never heard it. I dreamt of a less civilized age, an age where some still practiced the old ways, the dark ways. Do you understand? No, perhaps you don't. But I needn't tell you the whole of it. It is enough that you envision the ignorance and turbidity of medievalism. It was in such an age when men were sometimes put to death for dabbling in the old ways. And I tell you that I have had the opportunity to watch such a spectacle with my own eyes. The man accused was in the prime of his life, a fair and lithe thing whose recent workings and dark rites had earmarked him for execution. This youthful specimen was strung to a tall wooden pillar, and kindling was piled about his feet. A throng of villagers sought to burn him, and they flung their many torches into that tinder, spat at him, cursed him. The prisoner pleaded for his life, inhaled the smoke, struggled against his restraints. But in time death took him, if only temporarily. I wish that I could relate to you the raw terror in the faces of those serfs when the body of the accused man did not burn. Yes, I tell it truthfully. Though the fire consumed the tinder, ate away at the robes that held him, the youth's corpse remained untouched. And I can tell you why it was spared. It was because of all the many dabblers in forgotten rites. The devil loved this one best. Panic set in. Further attempts to damage the body proved fruitless. It was reported that his alabaster skin was tough as stone, and that those lungs which had so recently gasped their last now fluttered with a new diabolical life. When the fire had burned through the platform, the restraints, the corpse was set free. And as a marionette moves at the behest of a string, so too did the dead man stand and cast his empty gaze upon those gathered. The peasants fled, uttering their prayers. Meanwhile, the captive took flight on the devil's own wings and was gone. The nights were filled with a new terror as the dead man returned. He was seen from the fields as night reared its head, floating above the trees like a kite with no master. The townsfolk were forced to avoid their windows, lest they spy the revenant lingering thereabouts. It was said that the dead man's eyes were the color of smoke, and that to look into them was to invite it into one's home. In those domiciles where the revenant paid a visit, none survived. Those so struck down would appear to have been burnt as if on a pyre, though nothing in their surroundings would have been charred. Some avoided this fate by wearing blindfolds after dark. When the figure drew near the village, they would hide and cover their eyes with something to avoid meeting its gaze. Even those who fled to other regions continued this tradition. I wager some keep to it still, for nothing good ever came of staring too long into the night. And that is an old truth. Many a town succumbed in this fashion. One supposes that the figure still remains, haunting distant hillsides, sustained on an ancient devilry. On the face of it, this strange tale was an obvious fabrication. Under any other circumstances, I'd have had no trouble dismissing it out of hand, regarding it as merely the ramblings of the deranged. But I must confess that the seed was thus planted. It's easy for one to hear this account secondhand and laugh it off as nonsense. But for the man who stood in the crashing rain and listened, with increasing interest and unease, I hasten to add, to the old man's croaking voice, it left an immense impression and incited a creeping dread the likes of which I'd never experienced. You will understand, then, that when my cab finally pulled up against the swollen curb some moments later, I lowered my umbrella and ran for it. I'd never been so happy to see a yellow taxi in all my life. As I fled the office building, I heard the man shaking his coin box, demanding payment for that sordid little yarn of his, no doubt. He shook it repeatedly, and with increasing ferocity as I rushed to my ride. Would that I had nothing more to tell. There was one last thing I noticed as I entered the cab. Panting, I told the driver my address, then chanced one more glance outside into the rain-dappled scenery. I studied the building's exterior, meaning to catch one last glimpse of that strange little man, but finding him absent. He had not struck me as particularly spry, and the fact that he'd vanished from sight completely in the space of a few moments left me puzzled and unnerved. I would have been too pleased to leave it at that, to have forgotten the old fellow and his bizarre dream as the cab pulled away and I returned home. But I am afraid that this is just the start of it. At the time, I was living on the top floor of an old apartment complex on the cusp of town. My unit's sole window looked out across a vast field. Whenever it rained, this patchy lot was transformed into a soupy morass, and on this sodden evening it had been so rendered. I went about my routine in the hours after my return, ate something, took a shower, but at no point did I manage to fully overcome the unease that had earlier taken root. Whenever it seemed on the verge of abating, I'd remember the leering old man, the grotesque lilt of his voice, and even the bizarre medieval landscape he'd described from his dream. As sleep approached and I failed to completely purge the details of that dream in black static from my mind, I sat on the edge of my bed, eyes closed, and fancied I could smell the burning tinder, could hear the footfalls of 15th century peasants in retreat. It was nearly midnight when I finally set my sights on sleep, and I began putting out the lights. No sooner had I switched off the light in my bedroom did I hear something just outside the doorway, however. I stood in the darkness, completely still, and devoted everything I had towards listening. I was sure that I was simply going insane. All the same, the noise I'd heard had sounded something like the ringing of coins in a wooden box. With a mind towards investigating the sound, I took a stroll through my dark apartment, gliding silently from one room to another and assuring myself that it had been the jangling of a dog's leash in the next apartment or the clanging of a loose pipe in the building. I had almost convinced myself that I'd misheard when it rang out again. This time, it was too clear to deny. And what's more, the sound had originated outside my door from the communal hallway. A queasy fear stirred to life in me. It wasn't until the rattle of coins sounded a third time that I found sufficient courage to sneak to the door and peer through the peephole. In doing so, I was frustrated to find the hallway empty, and more than that, dark, for one of the bulbs in the ceiling fixture had apparently just burned out. Desperate to put the strange business behind me, I marched off to bed. The lights in my room were put out for the second time, and I went to shut the blinds too, to keep off the glare of the moon. As I fiddled with the cord, however, I glanced out the window, across the soupy lot, and found something that robbed my legs of strength. I nearly toppled over at the sight of something. No, it would be more accurate to say someone, hovering high in the air some distance away. My first thought had been that it was a kite, a large one, but the stark humanoid shape it cut against the turbulent sky suggested otherwise. The possibility that it was some large species of bird proved untenable as well. Distant though it was, I could make out four limbs on the thing. In the glow of the moon, its flesh looked white as porcelain. Clouds of blowing mist wreathed its rigid body. I backed away from the window, head spinning. Surely I was dreaming? With a quivering hand, I steadied myself against the wall and leaned towards the window for another look. I sought anything I could find to keep me tethered to reality, something to keep me from spinning off into some mad, dark world. But on second glance, the situation outside had only taken another staggering step into nightmare country. A wicked haze was rolling in from the distance, a harshly obscuring wave more of darkness than of mist. It was as though the rain had stopped falling, only to remain suspended in the air. And as the droplets hung cemented in the darkness, each of them fell somewhere onto a kaleidoscopic palette of pitch. The resulting effect was, I realized, like looking out my window into a storm of black static. And in the midst of that storm, having drawn nearer since my last look, shone the alabaster figure, still suspended in the air like a twisted, staring mannequin. The thing looked carved of marble, unmoving and yet somehow gaining ground. The sound of rattling change pierced the silence as I cowered beside the window. This time, the noise had come from outside, from directly beneath my window, it seemed. However great my mounting terror, I had room enough then for a niggling rage. The old man from earlier, he'd found me somehow. Now he'd come to my home, was still angling for the handout I'd neglected to give him during our last meeting. I'd evidently misjudged the old man. My current troubles were plainly owed to his deft linguistic talents, to some hypnotic suggestion he'd planted during that odd and winding tale of his. I returned to the window, mildly invigorated by my anger and intending to curse at him. But the words were never realized. The scene had changed again, continuing its descent into abomination. The sky above and the moon that had hitherto been parked in it were no longer visible, nor was the field below. There existed now only the void of black static and the twisted white figure suspended within it. That figure was close now, close enough to remove any doubt as to its general shape, yet it remained mercifully far enough away to spare me the full weight of its stare. At sighting the thing, the smell of moisture in the air was replaced with the smell of a raging wood fire. What should have been a cool autumn breeze, pregnant with icy mist, was instead a noxious smoke that filled my lungs and accosted my eyes. And with this smoke came heat. I felt a distinct and unnatural warmth all about me, like I was standing very close to an unseen fire. That entity, what a hideous thing it was. Though its body was as proportional and picturesque as a Grecian sculpture, the perpetual pose it struck was in keeping with the very architecture of the nightmarish. Its lengthy, muscled arms were wrapped around its midsection, its legs bowed outward somewhat, only to cross at the ankles. It was the pose of a body leashed to a pillar. Once again, the rattling of the coin box sounded from the void. The coins clattered with great insistence, crashed like cymbals in the perfect silence. Having scrambled from the window, I backed deeper into my room, coming to a halt as I met the dresser with my back. Desperate to break the spell, I threw up an arm and knocked everything from the top of the dresser. My watch, wallet, and a small valet tray filled with spare change fell to the floor. At hearing the coins spill out all around me, I grabbed up as many of them as I could find and then crawled back to the window with fistfuls of quarters and dimes. The window was home now to a very different sight. Two stiff white legs hovered there, close enough that I might have reached out and touched them. The smell of fire waxed dominant. My lungs burned, eyes watered, and an incredible heat washed over me in nigh overwhelming waves. Then, very slowly, the floating corpse began to sink. The tips of its feet fell out of view, and I followed the curve of its calves. The tops of the legs, then a taut abdomen entered into view. Very soon now, a chest would enter into frame. It was lowering itself, inch by inch, and in no time at all would be looking in at me. It sought my eyes, wished to fix me with its dead stare. At the moment I glimpsed a twisted white neck, I cast my fistfuls of change out the window and buried my face in the carpet. "Leave me alone," I cried, fists balled. Pulses of raw heat buffeted me. I felt the sweat on my skin bubbling, then evaporating. The next thing I heard while I remained huddled against the floor were the coins raining down across the rain-soaked lot. There was a burst of furtive sloshing as some unseen gatherer set about plucking them up, and I heard each of them being noisily deposited into something like a wooden box shortly thereafter. Clink, 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 clink. Finally, after seeming eons, the phantom warmth retreated and the sound of the rain reached my ears. I can't tell you how long it took me to look to the window again. I was probably an hour in finally looking upward. And when I did, I saw that the rain had largely ebbed and the sill had grown very damp. Sometime later, I summoned the courage to crawl to the window and look outside. But when I did, I found only an empty lot. The rain quit soon thereafter, and the remainder of the night wore on in the expected fashion. You may be telling yourself that this story of mine was clearly some fever dream, that such things don't and can't happen in the real world. Believe what you will, but allow me to leave you with this. Traumatized though I'd been by the whole experience, I found something of reason when the sun reared its head, and through sheer stubbornness, I tried to convince myself of precisely that, that I'd suffered a nervous breakdown or had hallucinated the entire ordeal. I ventured out into that muddy lot outside in the minutes after sunrise, sure that no corroborating proofs existed. Out in the field, I found two things, however. First, I discovered that, despite my having tossed two handfuls of coins out my window, not a single dime remained in the field. It was entirely possible that someone had wandered by in the hours since my episode and picked them up, but how, in the darkness, had they managed to claim each and every one? Well, this was a strange thing, but not so strange that it could not be chalked up to the commonplace. The other thing I discovered in the field was harder to explain. And it's the chief reason why I no longer look out my windows at night, and why I make certain to carry spare change with me whenever I leave the house. I discovered a series of small footprints in the mud, directly below my window. They seemed to me small and gnarled prints, the kind that might well be left behind by ancient feet. I studied these prints for some time in the mounting dawn, and followed them a little ways. As far as was possible, anyhow. From my window, the maker of these tracks had turned and gone back across the vast field. There was a lengthy series of prints in the fresh mud, and as I said, I followed them for quite some distance. But eventually, I reached a point where the trail ended without explanation. Beyond the last set of prints, there existed only virginal mud. And a thorough exploration of the surrounding area turned up no recurrence of them elsewhere. The trail simply ended in the middle of a field. It was as if the individual had ceased to walk, like he'd taken to the skies on the devil's own wings.